on BCFM.
BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Let no man call us crazy. They called Hitler crazy, but Hitler wasn't crazy. He was stupid. You don't fight Russia and America. You get Russia and America to fight each other and destroy each other.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A new president of Malaysia, well, relatively new, and a new documentary on the 2015 downing of MH17. It's a call for justice, and it's produced by freelance Dutch journalist Max van der Werf. You won't be seeing it on the BBC. Why? Because it implicates fascists in Ukraine, with NATO and the Dutch authorities in falsifying evidence against Russia. So why would they cover up the real culprits who shot down the plane? Just to have a go at the Russians? And tanker wars. The latest, we go back to 1987, just before the first Gulf War, when US warships were escorting Kuwaiti tankers by sending the tankers out ahead of the warships in case of mines. Doesn't sound much like escorting to me. YouTube have been censoring my videos this week, classifying the linking of Israel and Israelis to the 9/11 attacks as anti-Semitic hate speech, apparently. We hear from Chris Bolin on the strong connections between Israeli Secret Service Mossad and the Hollywood film industry, making films very similar to 9/11 attacks. We're not saying that these film producers did it, we're just making these comparisons, but apparently that's hate speech. And Yukio Amano dropped dead this week. Who's he, I hear you say? Only the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Authority. He's charged with the oversight of the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. Plus, in Austria, a very serious case. News that one of their most dangerous mafia dons, Farouk Orman, is going to be released now. And possibly another, Tony Mockbell, because of their lawyer, Nicola Gobbo, was secretly a police informer all along. No special tariffs on Huawei, electronics firm from China. Just that FedEx's postal company is refusing to deliver their mail. Just another provocation against China from the Trump administration, jealous of the Chinese tech company's market lead. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon this week, the second of a two-part series on the Glastonbury Abbey sphere of influence before the dissolution in the 1530s. We hear how the medieval providers of education and medical care had their own army, which the abbot could summon from his home in Shapwick whenever he wanted it. And we travel to Mere and the vast lakes of fish used to feed the monks, presumably on a Friday, this region and beyond. So you can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to that, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, I think we better start with the tanker wars, because this time last week, the Iranians were descending onto a British registered tanker and have impounded it, haven't they?
Yeah, and what's really significant about this is the insurance for British tankers operating in the Gulf has shot through the roof, and various tanker operators are trying
to... But they just pass that on to the petrol companies, surely?
Well, no, what's happening is that basically people are re-registering their tankers as not British, because that's what you do to get around that, isn't it?
Where's this heading, then, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say.
They've released some of the crew, apparently.
Well, the crew, yeah. But they're still holding the Iranian tanker with its oil...
And, in Gibraltar.
in Gibraltar. And of course, they were trying to enforce what are supposedly EU sanctions, but Iran is not part of EU sanctions. And in any case, EU sanctions are not actually legal, because sanctions are supposed to be carried out via the UN Security Council, which obviously hasn't happened in this case.
So what's really going on behind the scenes, do you think?
Well, pretty clear, I think, that the deep state in Britain was told by the deep state in the US and the Israelis, who have their influence there, to seize this tanker as a way of dragging Britain into confrontation with Iran and splitting the British off from the French, the Germans and the other EU countries who want to carry on trading with Iran.
Let's be absolutely clear about this, and I'll put a link up on our show page to the map. You can see clearly that the tanker was seized in disputed Moroccan international waters, and then it was moved into the Gibraltar waters by the these Marines. So it was deliberately taken out of international waters. This does sound like piracy.
Well, it is. It is piracy. And of course, what's happened with the other ship, the British registered ship, the Stena Imperio, which means the Imperial Strait. The Mirror this week had a story saying that the Russians had used GPS hacking to confuse the ship and make it sail into Iranian waters, and therefore that's why it was seized. And I was asked to comment about this week on RT, but I couldn't do it because I was out of Bristol. And of course, what I would have said if I had commented for RT is,
okay, do your little RT
what the British have been saying is that they were in international waters, but what the Mirror is saying that they were in Iranian waters, but they'd been misled by the Russians into Iranian waters. Now, if they're in Iranian waters, there's no reason for the Iranians not to be able to interdict them if they want to. There's nothing that anybody can do to stop it. But of course, the question is, do we want to escalate this into everybody starts arresting everybody else's tankers?
Everybody seems to have forgotten about the tanker wars back in the Persian Gulf in 1987. This is 2 years before the first Gulf War. But the Iranians won't have forgotten that, and neither has the writer Robert Fisk, who's been writing mm-hmm. about this in the run-up to that first Gulf War. So this is not unprecedented at all, this sort of thing going on in that specific strait of water.
The Armilla Patrol, which was originally sent there, was sent there to protect essentially Iraqi. We were on the Iraqi side in the Iraq-Iran war. Basically, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980 to upset the Iranian revolution.
Would you do that for the Americans?
Sorry?
For the Americans, who were very annoyed.
And the British. Don't forget, the British and the Americans overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1954 because they nationalised the oil.
So the Iranians had their revolution in 1979, but very quickly, Armilla turns up.
Well, not Armilla, but very quickly Saddam Hussein invaded Iran because the same thing happened after the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. You have a revolution, but you're not allowed to have your revolution. The nearby powers immediately intervene to try and squash it. And Saddam Hussein invaded Iran on a pretext, supported by the West, including the British. And of course, he couldn't win the war. The Iranians were too tough for him. And then it turned into a war of attrition. And of course, the obvious thing that the Iranians were doing was trying to knock out Kuwaiti and Iraqi tankers, and that's why they started using the Americans gave Kuwaiti tankers they re-registered them as American tankers, but as you pointed out, as Robert Fisk pointed out in his article, when it came down to it, the military ships had to file behind the tankers, which are much bigger, because if the tankers hit a mine, they'd probably survive better than
that's the, right. They had a thicker hull, because actually it's a much bigger ship because you're just carrying all this oil rather than
the military point here. Tony, is that the Persian Gulf is actually a death trap for military ships who are opposed to the Iranians. It would be like the Iranians bringing their ships into the Channel and thinking that they were going to be able to beat the British in the Channel. It's just not going to happen.
That's right. The other thing that Fisk points out in this article, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, came out in the Independent Online on Monday and the iPaper on Tuesday, a shortened version, rather sadly shortened by I think it's Thompson that publishes the iPaper, is that these Armilla patrols, they finished in whatever it was, 19... 19- 90s. He points out that the ship that's now sailing out there, we announced to join the patrol, is only going to be two British ships there for a very short period of time. And then the other one has to come home. So although we're saying we're reinforcing our presence in the Gulf, it'll only be for a week or so. And then this next ship will have to go, or the first ship will have to start chugging back to Britain. We only have apparently now 19 surface warships, whereas even back in the 1980s, of course, all right, we had many more.
Well, this will be spun by the Tory press as we need to spend a load of money on new ships. Now, in actual fact, there is no way, if you go to war with the Iranians, that you will be able to protect any ships in the Gulf at all. They've got land-based anti-ship missiles, which will sink everything virtually immediately if you go to war with them. So you could say, we're having a British ship there to say, if you do shoot at us, then you're going to war with us. But there's no way that they can physically protect those ships. Basically, if there's a war in the Persian Gulf, all military ships which are hostile to Iran will be sunk almost immediately. The price of oil will shoot through the roof, and the world economy will collapse. It'll all happen in about 3 or 4 days, and lots of sailors will be killed, of course.
HMS Duncan and HMS Montrose going to Davy Jones Locker, do you think, or not?
Well, the Iranians do not want to fight, so they're not going to do it for the hell of it. But they've got to recognise that if you're going to make threats that you're going to shoot people, they may say, well, we're going to shoot back, and these are our waters, and you need to leave, just as we would do. Can you imagine if the Iranians or the Chinese or the Russians brought a flotilla into the channel and started making threats? They wouldn't last very long, because it's just the geography's against you, and the geography's completely against them here. And not to mention that all military analysis shows that they're definitely going to lose.
In a way, this Armilla patrol from the 1980s has given the Iranians a sort of reason to prepare their defences and to know exactly what to do.
They've been preparing for this battle for years and years and years and years and years. And they basically, look at the way they...
Take us through what you think might happen.
Well, the obvious thing that's going to happen is the Iranians have got such a strong hand that they're not looking for trouble. What they want is their ship to be released and for it to be allowed to carry on doing what it was doing. That's what this is all about.
But if
we started this, if we back off, then they'll back off.
If it turns nasty, what do you think are likely to be the sort of... which direction is it going to go? The United States... Are we talking about actually having US troops there?
Well,
British troops there? NATO troops there?
Well, the only way... If it starts, it'll start quickly and it'll escalate quickly. And the Iranians will have all the advantages in the initial phases.
The Americans have got
apart from the air power that which
the Americans
will be
have got one of these amphibious landing ships.
Yeah, but they're all in the US. You've got to bring them over the Atlantic first, and by the time they get there, the battle will be over.
No, they've got one over there.
Yeah,
now.
But one is not enough to invade a whole country like Iran. You can imagine an amphibious landing like D-Day took about 3 or 4 years to prepare, and you can't just have an amphibious landing. You know, the U.S. Marines storming ashore in Iran will be wiped out. Not to mention the ship they come from being sunk before they even get ashore. There's no chance of winning.
So what's this all about then? If they can't win militarily,
because they think that they can use nuclear weapons or something like that. I mean, what Sheldon Adelson said, who's the main funder of the Republican Party and a big supporter of Trump, is we should just use a nuclear weapon on Iran, because that's what the Israelis want. We could just nuke Iran and then there won't be a problem anymore. That's the mentality.
The Iranians have successfully tested, we hear today, a medium-range missile, and Britain is to escort all UK flag vessels through the Straits of Hormuz from now on.
Well, what's going to happen is that, as I say, the insurance companies have already made it clear that British flagships are going to have to pay a massive premium to operate there. So what's immediately happening is that everybody's not, you know, don't flag your ship, you know, just change the flagging on your ships. It's as simple as that. If it's only British ships that are going to be targets, well, let's have French ships, Japanese ships, whatever.
Well, it's not just in the Straits of Hormuz, or Persian Gulf, or the Gulf of Oman that tankers are being seized, or the Mediterranean. Ukraine has seized a Russian tanker, in the Black Sea. One does wonder whether this whole tanker seizure thing with special forces coming down from helicopters and taking over the wheel room of these tankers is catching on. So the Ukrainians, apparently, Martin, have just seized a Russian tanker in the Black Sea.
Well, it may be that, people who like to provoke... I mean, don't forget, there's a faction within the US and within the Ukraine that wants a war with Russia, that wants a war with Iran. So the escalation of this tanker seizure game could be their way to get the war started. And that's what they want. I mean, you've got to be absolutely clear about it. They want a war with Iran. they aren't looking to try and escape from a war with Iran. John Bolton, Pompeo, the people who, not Zelensky so much, but the military in Ukraine under the influence of NATO, the Ukrainians, they want
saying,
a war.
The Ukrainians are saying that this is a response to the clash last year underneath the
Kerch Strait.
The Kerch Strait incident. Yeah.
Well, yes, they can say that, but of course, if they do that, then the Russians are going to take countermeasures against them. It's like a game of chess. You can do that, and then the other side says, "Well, look, I can take your rook there."
I think one of the things
take your knight.
Millions of people are thinking about here is this going to actually start to really affect the price of fuel, so diesel and petrol at the pumps?
Well, it's already starting.
Those with their electric cars will be smiling, won't they?
Well, it's already starting. As I've said, see, there was an interesting suggestion by Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times, as a Brazilian. Very good, interesting suggestion. All the Iranians have to do is declare the Straits of Hormuz a war zone. They don't have to shoot anybody. Just declare it a war zone, and then the insurers won't allow ships to move. They will just push the price of insurance up so much that it's not worth your while putting a ship in there.
It's a little bit like that MH17 incident, which we'll be talking about in a minute, isn't it? Because actually that was a war zone when that aircraft was shot down,
yes,
amazingly.
And it was diverted over the war zone by Ukrainian air traffic control.
It went on a more northerly route that day, didn't it, for whatever reason, by Ukrainian
air
traffic control.
Well, the Ukrainian air traffic control deliberately directed it into the war zone.
Before we get away from the Middle East, let's have a listen to Theresa May and her last Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, where she was asked about Russian attacks on Idlib in Syria.
Victoria Prentice!
Speaker, 31 people were killed in Idlib yesterday and many tens of thousands of people displaced again. I would like to thank the Prime Minister for her personal commitment to Syria and for international development more widely. And I would like her to join with me in reassuring the people of Syria that all of us here will continue to remember them.
Yeah. Can I say to my honourable friend, first of all, I commend the work that she did in setting up Singing for Syria, which has been raising funds for people in Syria, and the commitment that she has shown to the people of Syria. We remain, and the Conservative government will remain, committed to working for a political solution in Syria that can provide the stability and security that the people of Syria deserve.
Well, there's been more people killed in Idlib today, but loads more people probably have been killed in Yemen, but we don't hear much about that. Idlib is under the control of the al-Nusra Front, which is the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda, and there's many thousands of non-Syrian rebels in that pocket. And of course, it's come to become absolutely clear that the so-called chemical weapons attack in Douma last year was actually basically a staged incident by the White Helmets, who've now been taken out of Syria by the Israeli intelligence services.
Yeah, Victoria Prentice is a Conservative MP for Banbury.
Well, there we are. Now, so in other words, and don't forget that the seizure of the Iranian tanker we've just been talking about, because they're supposedly going to deliver oil to Syria. Now, in actual fact, Iran doesn't have sanctions on Syria. Iran's Syria's ally, so why can't they deliver oil to them if they want? Now, you could say, well, they shouldn't be allowed to do that because we're at war with the Syrian regime. And we fired various missiles from Akrotiri's, based in Akrotiri in Cyprus. The RAF took their planes into the air and fired various missiles into Syria. And the Syrians wisely decided not to fire back, but they could have decided to fire back with their Russian allies and killed loads of RAF personnel, because loads of people have died in Syria since we started the war there with our support for jihadis in the 7 years ago.
Look, the big problem, of course, with Iran is, you're talking about Syria there, but Iran is the centre of this, really, and that is the United States pulling out of the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. And we've just seen this week the death of the guy who runs the International Atomic Energy Authority. Now, that is going to put the cat amongst the pigeons, surely. And also, we know that coups can happen in organisations like this, and that it all depends on these kind of international groups as to what's going to happen. We've seen also the use of these big international organisations like the International Atomic Energy Authority, the chemical weapons people, for example, including the Olympics Committee, actually being used as a tool of, at the very least, information war, in order to try and blacken the name of so-called enemy countries.
Well, the Organisation for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, gave a report where they basically said, as far as we're concerned, there was a chemical weapons attack. But their original report was leaked, which was by the original investigator, who's actually a technical expert, and he said it definitely didn't happen, and that the whole thing was staged. And that came out. So, in other words, these international organisations are supposedly independent, supposedly above the fray, and they should be in principle, but in practice, often they are not. They're being manipulated in various ways to come up with various results which have already been foreordained. So the OPCW basically said that there was a chemical weapons attack, even though their own internal advice was that there hadn't been one. And on the back of that, Britain fired missiles at the Syrian Arab Army, who've taken over 100,000 casualties. And, you know, they might have fired back and killed some British people, and then we'd have gone, oh, goodness, our British soldiers are dying. Help for heroes. It's like, you shoot at people, they're going to shoot back at you. They've got a right to shoot back at you. Just as the Houthi and the Yemeni army in Yemen have fired back at the Saudis. If you're going to keep bombing us, we're going to shoot back at you. Okay. Why are you allowed to shoot? We're not allowed to shoot back.
I mean, the big question, of course, is who's taking over in running the International Atomic Energy Authority. Well, the chap's name is Cornel Furuta, and he's a Romanian diplomat, and he's going to be the interim IAEA chief. He's a graduate of Tokyo University, Faculty of Law. He's from the Japanese Foreign Ministry, posted to jobs in Belgium, France, Laos, Switzerland, and the United States. He was then served as Japan's representative to the IAEA to his election of Director General in July 2009, including a stint as chair of the Board of Governors 2005-06. So he's very definitely not in the China-Russia camp. He's in the US and Romania and Japan camp.
Well, that's quite. I haven't really looked into this, Tony, but what you're suggesting doesn't sound at all implausible to me. It may be that this guy's just died anyway, and they use it as an opportunity to put somebody else.
Well,
in
I'm not suggesting there's anything fishy about it, but it's not really being.
No, it's not beyond the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld was definitely assassinated by the British and the Americans in the Congo.
The role of the International Atomic Energy Authority in all of this, and particularly the JCPOA, is absolutely crucial right now, isn't it?
It is. And of course, getting the right people into the right positions in these international organisations is a crucial battle that goes on all the time. Eventually, of course, if you cheat too much and you get your people in to get what you want, eventually people will just withdraw from it. The Iranians are part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've signed up to it, and therefore they could withdraw. You see, the Israelis aren't in it. The Israelis have absolutely refused to join the NPT. And the Iranians could just say, well, if the Israelis aren't in it, we're not in it either.
And they could maybe just leave. Yeah. Anyway, we mentioned briefly the MH17 shoot down at the beginning, but I think we should have a look at this new documentary. Thanks for sending it to me, Martin. It's absolutely hot off the press. If the documentaries can be considered to come off presses, I think actually they come out of transmitter towers. They're supposed to, but they don't come out of British transmitter towers anymore, all these decent documentaries. I mean, it's worth saying, isn't it, Martin, that sometimes back in the day, you used to get some pretty controversial documentaries out there. Nowadays, something like this would never be shown on British television, certainly not for a good long while, because it's absolutely forensic, and it shows that the MH17 almost certainly wasn't shot down by the Russians, and actually there's been quite a sophisticated cover-up involved in who really did shoot it down.
Yes, indeed. And of course, it's pretty obvious from the get-go that there's something extremely suspicious about the whole thing. And it wasn't that the Russians had sent a missile battery across the border to shoot a plane down for the hell of it.
It's significant as well that, of course, it's a Dutch journalist that's decided to go and make this film. I mean, he speaks to people from all over the world. But the big change has been with the change in the Malaysian president. He started to really speak out about this, saying it's just simply not on that Malaysia was shut out of the investigation.
Well, he's a rather significant figure because he's a very he's newly re-elected, but he ran Malaysia for quite a long time before that, and he's a very critical figure. The Malaysians are definitely not flavour of the month in the Western camp. They brought in exchange controls in 1998 when the economy collapsed, which the IMF told them not to, and they've also asked very big questions about 9/11 because it's a largely Muslim country.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how the way that Singapore and Malaysia are both actually quite independent-minded states in Asia, and they seems to me to be, they will go with whatever seems to be the most sensible direction to go. They're not going to be bullied and pushed around by the West in the way that many other countries are.
Well, that's right. They've got, I mean, there's a multipolar world order gradually developing. And, of course, the Western powers, the British, the Americans, the Israelis, have got used to just giving the orders and everybody else going,
I mean,
the
Malaysians
to carry on.
The Malaysians even put Bush and Blair on trial for war crimes in absentia, which means that neither of them can now, and they were found guilty, means neither of them can now travel to Malaysia, plus several senior Israeli politicians and military people also cannot travel to Malaysia because they've been tried in absentia.
Well, that's right. Well, that's one of the reasons why a Malaysian plane was chosen for this provocation. If you're going to shoot a plane down, let's make it theirs. And, of course, why weren't they allowed into the investigation since it was their plane?
Anyway,
fascinating, isn't it?
The documentary is called MH17, A Call for Justice. Let's have a listen to a little clip now where they talk about some of the evidence, Martin. And this, in a way, is incredible, isn't it? That they would use phone-tapping evidence in order to, as part of the investigation. Because, of course, with something like phone-tapping evidence, you can have thousands and thousands of hours, and then you can choose X, Y, and Z, little bits that suit
you.
Well,
also, the phone-tapping evidence came from the Ukrainian secret services, who are actually the main suspects.
In Malaysia, we found certified audio experts who prepare reports for court cases. They verify the authenticity of the phone taps for us.
This is left channel, right channel, they are just totally different. I can see there is a difference of the noise, and I also can see they are basically some kind of merging of an audio.
This is edited.
Yes, it's edited.
That's clear.
Yes.
How is it clear?
So, look at the noise level, right? The noise level is different from this audio track. If you hear, see this audio track, the noise level at this area, they're different. And this is lower, and this is higher.
Which means that this part of the conversation is compiled of different parts of different conversations.
Yes, it's a merging of different
merging.
Audio. Yes.
Merging of different.
This two are same sound. You can hear? So suddenly this, he added this this particular word here, probably to hide something to make the link. And here you can see so many cut. This is clear.
Oh, these are cuts. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see. Missing audio. What is this conversation? It could be there's some conversation here. They just cut it, and then just leave the last part. You can see that.
It looks the strangest.
Yeah.
You know, like,
you see?
So different.
Yeah. It clearly shows that these are two different recordings.
Okay. I cannot understand why must Ukraine involve with the investigation. But I do not know why Malaysia was not involved.
Yes, I do not know why Malaysia was not involved in the... It's incredible, isn't it, that a NATO country sympathetic to Ukraine can just take over the investigation, in this case Holland, the British taking possession of the black box and shut the Malaysians entirely out of their own inquiry?
Well, it's what they've not followed any kind of international procedure. And also, of course, they immediately decided that the Russians had done it and slapped sanctions on Russia, which have continued to this day with all kinds of ramifications. So why don't they... You'd say, well, why haven't you followed ordinary procedure here? And the reason they haven't followed ordinary procedure is the whole thing's a provocation, basically. A provocation by the Ukrainian security services, the SB, and their NATO allies.
What about these allegations that they're actually quite... Well, not just neo-Nazi, but actually pro-Nazi groups in Ukraine.
Well, there's no doubt.
I mean, Stefan Bandera, for example, being a Ukrainian Nazi that they revere. They have pictures of him up on their wall.
They're pretty obvious. They're pretty open about it. And of course, people like Paribi was in charge of the military on that day. They've got means, motive.
He then resigned, didn't he?
He's now Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, the Rada. But they've got means, motive and opportunity. And if you say, oh, NATO would never shoot down a plane in order to make the Russians look bad, I say, you don't know what you're talking about. NATO has been carrying out provocations like this for years. They bombed Bologna railway station. They bombed Piazza Fontana in 1969. Yeah, this is the sort of thing they do. And they said they wouldn't kill innocent people to make a point, would they? And the answer is, they would, and they have.
Yeah, the documentary is called MH17, A Call for Justice. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The journalist behind it, the Dutch journalist, is Max van der Werf.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open, and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free, and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Extraordinary story broke today, Martin. Farouk Orman, he will be released. He's an organised crime boss in Australia because his lawyer was a police informer, and the police have been trying to keep this quiet for a long, long time. Nicola Gobbo is his lawyer, but she was secretly working as an informer for the police. It's really silly for the police to be having police informers as lawyers, because this, I mean, it was almost bound to happen eventually that this would come out.
Well, I don't know much about this case. It was the first time I've heard of it. And, of course, it's very difficult to fight organised crime.
They're all appealing their convictions now, this lawyer was working with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, if it turns out that that's the case, then they've just messed it up completely, haven't they? And that doesn't mean that the people concerned are innocent. It just means that the police have made a mess of it.
So, at the end of the day, how do you defeat organised crime? Because they needed someone, it looks like, they needed someone who was trusted by some of these mafia people and some of the mafia lawyers to infiltrate the circle of lawyers in order to get information on who it was that they really needed to arrest. It almost seems as if it's impossible to arrest the mob. These organised criminals are so well organised that the police may as well not bother.
Well, I'll give you two ways you're going to defeat organised crime. You've got to legalise drugs and you've got to disband the intelligence services.
That's a bit provocative. Legalised drugs, how is that going to help?
Well, because a lot of the power of organised crime has definitely come about since the CIA started running drugs out of China in the 1940s, and that's the drugs intelligence service network is absolutely, you know, that's what it's all about, really. I've just been reading stuff about Meyer Lansky, who was a big gangster in the US in the 1930s onwards, eventually went off to Israel, and of course what you do is these people are basically being protected. They're being protected by the intelligence services, because the intelligence services use all the dirty money, which they can siphon off from this, to do all their sort of stuff, like arranging for planes to be blown up, etc., etc. That's the real world we live in. Now, we need honest coppers, but we also need sensible laws. You've got to legalise drugs so that we can control the drugs market, and you've also got to recognise that the intelligence services are criminals. They're both drug dealers and terrorists, as I'm quite sure people in, the Syrian army are absolutely completely well aware.
So Meyer Lansky, who was he? Was he involved in Hollywood, that sort of thing? Well,
yeah, he was involved in everything. I mean, he basically created Las Vegas. And, you know, Al Capone's a fairly low-level person. Meyer Lansky was, and Luciano and Lansky were probably the most serious organised criminals in the US in the 1930s and onwards. But, of course, Luciano was let out of prison so that he could help the Allies win the battle in Italy in the 1940s. And, of course, the quid pro quo was that the Mafia were put in charge of southern Italy by the Allied forces as they went into Italy. Which, of course, then led to the Gladio networks, which were then set up, and all the rest of it.
What about Meyer Lansky? Was he Jewish?
Jewish guy, yeah.
So you're anti-Semitic for calling him a criminal?
I don't suppose he was a particularly religious Jew, but he was Jewish.
So you're anti-Semitic for calling him out
as a criminal? Bugsy Siegel, his right-hand man, was also Jewish. But Luciano was definitely...
Are you anti-Semitic?
No, I'm not. I deny it completely.
Well, what would you say? Because, I mean, if you're...
No, listen, if Jewish people do bad things, are we not allowed to say that they've done bad things because they're Jewish? That's absurd.
Well,
yeah, we've got to judge people by their behaviour, not by their ethnic origin.
You're moving seamlessly, beautifully, segueing into our next story, which is about my YouTube channel being censored. I was particularly irritated because I thought was a terrific show. I would say that, wouldn't I? Last year with Richard Gage and Ian Henschel, and YouTube have decided that it's anti-Semitic hate speech.
Well, at one stage, I looked at how many people had looked at it. We had 30,000 people had looked at that or listened to that show. How many hits did it die with? Do we know?
No, because they just cut it off.
So we don't know.
And I put in a little appeal saying, well, there's nothing anti-Semitic in here. This is just criticism of certain... I mean, actually, most of it is nothing to do with anything to do with Israel. No. But there's certain aspects of it which link to Israel.
Yeah.
It's a forensic thing. It's not anti-Jewish. They just decided, oh, your appeal, we've just dismissed it. We're not interested
in that. You can,
so it actually says now, if you try and go up onto YouTube and view it, it says this has been removed due to hate speech.
Well, isn't it interesting that it wasn't hate speech for quite a long time and then suddenly it is? And you know what that is? It's because basically it's beginning...
There is no, by the way, explanation by YouTube whatsoever as to what specific part of that video they have decided to take the whole thing down.
Yeah, well, presumably they've had their arms...
It violates our community guidelines... And we're not going to say where or how, and here and now you have to then have to appeal.
Well, as you know, Ofcom, the UK Lawyers for Israel, had a complaint about this show, which was knocked back by Ofcom.
Which was proved to be Israeli Foreign Ministry, actually.
Well, yes, but I mean, okay, but I think what's happened is they've gone around, they've looked at other things we've done, and so they've found another way to try and close us down, which is to go to YouTube and say, well, this is hate speech, take it down. And of course, YouTube basically are either in their pocket or under their pressure. But I think it's very interesting when something like this is taken.
This is Google, by the way, who've just announced profits.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting when something like this happens, when a show like that is taken down, it's a pretty clear indication of what they don't want you to hear. And anybody listening to this show now should get a copy of that show, which is out there, and they can get a copy of it, and then you listen to it, and you make up your own mind what you think.
Yeah, I mean, it does actually make me feel pretty horrible when you put all this time and effort into something, and then they do that, and accuse you again of something, which is actually libelous, saying that we're doing hate speech here, which we're not. What I've decided to do is to start putting these onto the Russian version of Facebook, vk.com.
Yeah.
What you can then do is just leave it there, and they have what seems to be a much more robust system for whether something's going to be taken down. So my video is up on vk.com now, and all any future ones that get removed, I shall be putting them up on there. Well, and this is the company which Snowden started working for when he went to Russia.
Yeah, well, I mean, the answer to this, if Google and Facebook and all these other Western-oriented tech companies very much in the pocket of the intelligence services in the West carry on censoring things, then we just smash their business model by not putting our stuff up on there, put it up somewhere else.
Yep, good idea. And what you said earlier was absolutely right about things being there for a long time and then suddenly being taken down. One of the things I found so fascinating was one of my interviews that I put up there was actually just a clip of a very, I thought, what was quite a good, intense, short section of a long interview by Chris Bolin back in 2015. And he decided to go through some of the people he thought may have been responsible for the 9/11 attacks, many of whom were Israelis. And it's not anti-Semitic. I mean, how can you say it's not? It's not. He's just presenting evidence that in one way or
which
another...
Which may or may not be correct.
Yes, in one way or another, that they're linked with either with the attacks themselves or with the sorts of films and things like that which were presaging. And here he is, and this is one of the bits that YouTube took down this week, where he talks about a chap called, oh gosh, I can't remember his name now, but anyway, he was an Israeli film director over in Hollywood, who did films which were very sort of like planes crashing into buildings and this sort of thing. And anyway, this is what Chris Bolin had to say.
Okay, here's another guy. This man here in the middle is Arnon Milchan. He is Israel's main Mossad agent in Hollywood. He's also the senior agent of Lechem. Lechem was a super secret Israeli operation to get American nuclear technology to Israel for their nuclear program. It was started by Shimon Peres, and this was Shimon Peres and this guy are best friends. Well, this guy came to Hollywood, and these are basically his property. These people make movies. This is a Brent Pitt and Angelina Jolie. and he makes movies in which these people are star, and he made movies like JFK, in which, of course, who's the guilty party? Some nebulous group at the CIA. He made Brazil, another movie where bombs go off all the time without making any sense. A futuristic film. Bombs go off here, bombs go off there. Terrorism is a fact of life. Very much like Iraq has become. Like Iraq has been for the last 10, 13 years. Bombs go off here, bombs go off at funerals, bombs go off in restaurants. Here he is with his two of his big friends, Shimon Peres, who he calls his best friend, and Bibi Netanyahu. He made a movie in 1978 in England, France and England, called The Medusa Touch. And in this movie, the climactic scene is a 747 flying into the Pan Am building. And this is how they're arranging the props to make this scene possible for their movie. Here's the book. Peter Van Greenlay, don't let the name fool you. This man is actually a Jewish writer. The publisher is a Jewish publisher. And as we know, the man who made the movie is a Mossad agent. And Richard Burton, I haven't seen the watch the movie too closely myself, but my friend down in Seguin watched it the other night, and he said that the symbolism in this movie is very interesting. He said, I'm dying to watch it now that he's told me about this, but it's a lot of anti-Christian symbolism in the movie. But Richard Burton says, I am the man with the power to create catastrophe. Because Richard Burton has this sort of telekinesis power where he imagines something happening and it happens. And churches get blown up, and buildings get blown up, and planes fly into buildings. This is 1978 he made this movie. Then he was involved in another movie he made in 2000 in Vancouver, Canada, and in New York City, in which a plane here flies into the World Trade Center. And in the movie, this plane has a passenger flight which has been remotely hijacked by superior computer technology. And then the plane narrowly, here they're pulling up, and the plane just narrowly misses the World Trade Center. He made this movie, The Lone Gunman. It's a pilot episode of a series by the same title. And in this he made with Rupert Murdoch, because Rupert Murdoch and Arnon Milchan were partners in their TV production company called New Regency. So you ask yourself, which writer had the brilliant idea to fly planes in the World Trade Center? And to make this scene, they actually flew helicopters along the flight path of the plane.
So predictive programming is what they call it, but it's the idea that fiction can sometimes imitate reality in reverse order.
Well, I think the important thing that people need to get here is that this guy admitted that he was a Mossad agent. So when Chris Berlin says that he's a Mossad agent, the guy actually boasted about being a Mossad agent. He said, yes, I've been a Mossad agent
for
years.
Well, actually, Haaretz has got an article about him, a quite recent one, actually, from February last year. The Israeli James Bond, they call him, Arnon Milchan, and his ties to the secret services. The movie mogul at the centre of a corruption case involving Prime Minister Netanyahu has led the kind of life he often shows on the big screen. Arnon Milchan, a key figure in corruption case threatening Netanyahu, which seems to have been forgotten about now, is best known as the producer of such Hollywood blockbusters as Pretty Woman and L.A. Confidential. I mean, these are extremely powerful people in the cultural industries,
yeah, well,
aren't they?
All right, well, let's try and cut to the chase here. Something like the 9/11 attack is planned long in advance. You know, it's not dissimilar to the Operation Northwoods plan in the early 60s, where planes were going to be blown up and there's going to be big casualties, and it was going to be blamed on Cuba, and the Americans were going to blame Cuba. Now, people shouldn't just presume that the Israelis are the only culprits on 9/11. They're not. They've definitely got allies inside the Western deep state. They don't operate on their own. But of course, they've got a long-term agenda, and they basically they use their control of mass media to create suggestions in people's minds about what can and can't happen. So Brazil, for example, very interesting film, but of course it's basically putting, you know, they're playing games with people's minds so that when the incident does happen, people have already been pre-programmed to think that something
like
that might
happen. Well, I mean,
let's
focus on Milchan himself, Martin, because more has been revealed since even then, and this is back last year. Police recommended in Israel that Milchan be indicted on bribery charges for showering Netanyahu and his wife Sara with lavish gifts, allegedly in exchange for help in various pursuits that required the Prime Minister's political clout. According to the police, Netanyahu received $1 million shekels, about $250,000 worth of champagne, cigars, jewellery and clothing on demand and systematically from Milchan on Australian billionaire James Packer. Milchan was the key supplier, though, supplying about three quarters of the gifts, the Israeli police are saying. In an interview broadcast on Israeli television, Milchan confirmed long-standing speculation he had worked as an agent for Israel's clandestine security service for many years, purchasing arms for the country and insisting on the development of nuclear capabilities the foreign media attribute to Israel. The state has never confirmed or denied any of Milchan's claims.
Well,
I mean, he's a legitimate person to investigate, for goodness sake. The Israeli police are investigating.
Of course he is. And, of course, Epstein, who's, you know, popping in and out of the news, he has got very strong links to the Israeli intelligence services as well.
What do you make of that, anyway, Epstein case?
Well, what you've got to recognise is that we were talking about Meyer Lansky earlier. The link between organised crime, which is dominated, for example, in Russia by people of Jewish origin, it just is, and the intelligence services of the Israelis in particular, but also the other Western intelligence services, this is where all of this stuff comes together. This is what you're up against. It's intelligence services, right-wing extremists, and organised crime, which is involved in sex and drugs trafficking.
Okay, so I'll put some links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to those censored films, now uploaded onto vk.com, and I put them up on briefly on Facebook as well. Maybe that wasn't the most sensible place to put them. I mean, you do feel, Martin, that some of these tech giants are actually now really hostile to the truth for a long time. They have been able to capture a lot of the thoughts and sentiments of people who are disillusioned by the mainstream media, very controlled mass media. They've all been moving over to social media because people can share that a lot more easily. Now they're clamping down and they're starting to say, well, if you're going to criticise Israel, that's hate speech.
Well, that's right. But of course, what I would say that it's like a game of chess. What you're doing by closing down that particular show, for example, is you're putting a red light on it. This is what you need to know, folks. This is what you need to listen to, because that's why they don't want you to hear it.
Also, the Miami Show Band Massacre. This came up in the news a few weeks ago. We didn't cover it then, but I think it would be also, since we've had a listen to the soundtrack from the MH17 documentary earlier, have a little listen to that. But before we do, Martin, this Miami Show Band Massacre was one of the most horrific things that happened during the Northern Ireland Troubles, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically the Miami Show Band were a, you know, basically a show band. They used to go around playing gigs in rural and small towns in Ireland, and they were pulled over to the
country music, was it?
Well, it's all sorts of things. Yeah, it's what they call Cayley band music. As far as I know, I've never been a great fan of it.
Okay, so were they from the Republic or from the North?
I'm not quite sure. But the thing is, they all got killed at a roadblock run by, I think, the UDA. But of course, the suggestion was that it's actually being run by the intelligence service.
So who is the UDA?
The Ulster Defence Association was set up at the beginning of the Troubles, really. The UVF already existed. And, of course, the first bomb planted during the Troubles was a UVF bomb of a transmitter, which was blamed on the IRA, even though the UVF had done it. Now, of course, what you've got in Northern Ireland is on a small scale.
These were loyalist terrorists.
These are loyalist terrorists. Yeah. What you've got in Northern Ireland is on a smaller scale, the same kind of manipulation and skullduggery that goes on a bigger scale in things like 9/11.
So let's have a listen now to a clip from that. Again, not the BBC. This is Netflix only.
The Miami Show Band, who's Ireland's most glamorous band.
They were our superstars.
The Irish Beatles.
We all lived in the Republic.
But we were an extremely popular band in Northern Ireland.
At that time, the conflict in Ireland was raging.
We were dealing with a huge level of violence.
Terrorism by the paramilitary groups escalated. I bought into this idea that musicians were immune.
There was shooting, there was screaming. It was like an absolute war zone.
I didn't accept that they were dead. I thought somehow or other this was just a bad dream.
The intention clearly was the bomb would kill all of them.
Questions were being raised,
and quite clearly it was an inside job.
They had to find out how far up this went. They murdered my friends. They left me for dead. They tried to frame me and my entire family as terrorists.
The report went up the chain of command.
and then poof, nothing happened.
It's been over 40 years, but we're finally getting closer to the truth.
Well, of course, the point about this is it's not just the loyalist paramilitaries, that it was actually orchestrated by the intelligence services, those criminals that we've been pointing the finger at in this whole show.
In this case, we're talking about who? Because MI5, actually, they weren't involved through the whole of the Troubles period, were they? As I understand it, it was Army intelligence, and then MI5...
Well, you've got a whole smorgasbord.
And special branch for
the police.
You've
got a whole smorgasbord of different people. Of course, the Lochin Island massacre film that's just been... there's been all the fuss about that. That was RUC. That was the RUC protecting the loyalists. In this occasion, the Glenane gang that carried out the 1972 Dublin and Monaghan massacres killed 27 people, injured hundreds.
That was in the south?
That was at Dublin and Monaghan, yeah. Both in the south. The Glenane gang have never been questioned about any of it, and the Irish police are pretty much convinced that they got the explosives and the whole idea for the attacks from MI5. Now, you've got to remember that the British state has got various, you've got RUC Special Branch, you've got MI5, you've got MI6, you've got Army Intelligence, you've got the Force Research Unit, you've got the 14th Debt and all the rest of it. They're all putting their finger in and stirring the pot. And, of course, most of what people think they know about what happened during the war in Ireland is simply wrong. Lots of things went on which most people who live in comfortable circumstances don't realise. And, of course, it's a microcosm of what's going on in the wider world.
So why have we got to find out about what really happened at the Miami Showband massacre? Why have we got to go to Netflix to find that out?
Well, because, as you all know, there is an enormous amount of manipulation by the mainstream media. Certain things don't get talked about at all.
This is rammed down your throat. This is decades ago, though.
The point about history, Tony, is that if people started to get the idea of what the state is capable of, then when the next bomb goes off, they think, hang on a minute, I don't quite believe the story you're telling me here. That's why this history is so important.
And now the government are talking about quite what Boris's attitude is going to be to this, about allowing or stopping any kind of investigations into army practices during the Troubles.
Well, that's because they don't want this can of worms to be opened.
We even had, is it Karen Bradley, the former Northern Ireland Secretary, saying, oh, well, if it was done by the army, then it's above the law.
Well, the most important part of this is we're not talking about shooting the odd person in a roadblock, is that the British Army's Force Research Unit, led by Brigadier Gordon Kerr and John Ware, who's just done this hit job on Jeremy Corbyn for Panorama.
A hatchet job.
Yeah, but he did a very good job of exposing Brigadier Gordon Kerr. And Brigadier Gordon Kerr was basically in charge of the loyalist paramilitary campaign. So everybody killed by the loyalists, and there were hundreds of them, the British Army were directly responsible for that, and they should have been sent to prison. But they weren't sent to prison, they were given a medal and a pat on the back.
We seem to be talking quite a lot about censorship this week. Twitter has also suspended Iran's news agencies over harassment of the Baha'is. So that's one reason to do it. I wonder if that's the main reason. Young Journalist Club YJC, run by state broadcaster IRIB, state-run INRA, and Mayor News Agency were among the Farsi language accounts which were suspended last Saturday by Twitter. Some agencies, including Farsi Agency and English Language Press TV, have remained active, though, on Twitter. The affected agencies speculated the suspensions were linked to their coverage of tensions in the region. In particular, they believed they were being penalised for their reporting of Iran's seizure of the British flag tanker in the Gulf on Friday. So the thing is with these kind of suspensions by Twitter is they just say, sorry, your account is suspended, and no one really knows why. But we can guess it's to do with that, not the Baha'i faith.
Well, I think you're probably right. And I think what's why we're getting an awful lot more censorship than we had, say, a year ago, 2 years ago, is because we're that much closer to war. And, of course, in wartime, then truth is very much the first casualty.
What about the comparison, then, between the protests in France and those in Hong Kong? Because this is a brilliant article I thought was on. I thought I'd have a look onto Fars News Agency. Is it Iranian? Yes, it is. And they're saying, well, isn't it interesting the way that we report the French protests and the way we report the Hong Kong protests? We've just heard today that the main airport has been almost, well, not quite closed down, but certainly the protests are right inside the airport in Hong Kong now. And that is seen to be, people upholding democracy, whereas in France, it's a whole bunch of troublemakers causing civil unrest.
Well, that's right. It's the double standards of everything that's extraordinary, isn't it? When people in countries we don't like protest, they're regarded as heroes, even though in Iran, for example, they burned down a police station and all the rest of it. But if we burned down a police station here, we'd be anarchists and sent to prison for 25 years. But there you go. There's no truth, there's no justice, just us.
The German... Okay, so this is another story which I found fascinating this week. The anti-vaccination sentiment is backed by the populist movement. That is a story on CNN. They're saying that parents in Germany who fail to vaccinate their children will now face hefty fines after the German government backed a bill requiring all children to receive measles, mumps jab, etc., before entering schools or kindergartens. So we're talking now, I mean, this is a little bit like the state taking over our kids. It's rather like saying that if you want to take your children on holiday, then you have to pay a fine. Now, if you don't want your children vaccinated, you also have to pay a fine in Germany.
Well, I mean, there are legitimate arguments about all of these things, Tony, but the question is censorship ever legitimate? You may not agree with what people say, but shutting them up doesn't stop them thinking it. It just makes the whole debate that much weaker.
At the end of the day, whose are the children? Are they yours or the state's when it comes to school, taking them to school or not, or getting them vaccinated or not?
This is a totally different topic from censorship.
It is, I know.
All right, well, that's okay. Well, let's move on then.
I would argue
as somebody who works with children that children have independent rights, independent of their parents and the state. That doesn't mean that the state or the parents don't have some rights as well, but the rights of the children, and it's all enshrined in UN charters.
I mean, I've covered on this program, Martin, I've covered on this program falsifying of documents to do with, particularly to do with the Infanrix Hexa vaccine, which is supposed to be given to infants, and the falsifying of data, which actually, when you have a good look at it, shows that this is actually harming more children than it helps. It's five different things in one, apparently. Anyway, I'll put a link up to that on our show page. Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 now. We're on thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can comment or complain, whatever you like. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here on Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show, though, at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
National news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.